Two and a Half Admins, episode 242. I'm Joe.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Alan.
And here we are again. And before we get started, your customary article plug, Alan, is network offload and socket splicing in FreeBSD.
Yeah, so this is an article about some work we recently contributed to the FreeBSD project that allows you to do socket splicing. So if you have an application like a load balancer, like Nginx, or a proxy, or something like RelayD that you're using for filtering or whatever, when it needs to move messages from one socket to another socket, instead of having to copy that from the kernel out into user space, go through the application, and then copy it back into the kernel to go out the other socket, you can say, hey, kernel, take socket A and socket B and splice them together and just let all the traffic through and tell me if when the connection closes or something happens. And it can go a bit further where you can put limits either in time or bytes on it. So if it's, for example, a load balancer and you have like a keep alive connection where it's going to have one request and you send a file and then there'll be another request, you can actually have the application look at the content length header and say, okay, the web server is now going to send a 7 megabyte file. So for the next 7 megabytes, have the kernel splice the socket and send the data over. But as soon as that's done, come back to the application so the web server will see the second request and decide how that should be routed because maybe it's to a different backend or whatever. Anyway, it can greatly increase your throughput and reduce latency and save CPU time and let you get more performance out of small machines that are doing network filtering, whether it's virus scanning, proxies, or even just a load balancer.
Right, well, link in the show notes as usual. A story that keeps coming up is AI crawlers from various companies completely ignoring robots.txt and effectively DDoSing various websites and projects, some open source projects, Wikimedia, and even you, Jim, you have fallen victim to this.
Unfortunately, yes, I have. I had a really bad day. My wife told me first thing in the morning that she had tried to log on to our billing application, and it was refusing to accept a password so she couldn't send invoices out to our clients. And I had thought that, well, you know, maybe an apt update, you know, so we got a new PHP version and, you know, some poorly coded function in this application no longer works the new version of PHP, which has happened before and I've had to fix before, but it turned out no, problem was simpler than that. The damn AI bots from Amazon and from OpenAI had been hammering the absolute Jesus out of my antique FreeBSD wiki, which is hosted on the same server, and had filled the entire server's hard drive with log files just from constantly asking for the recent changes, not even for the whole wiki, for just one article every other second. And I don't mean every other second between all the AI scrapers. I mean, Amazon was hitting recent changes for an article every 2 seconds. OpenAI was hitting one every 2 seconds. I also saw Anthropic in there, although for whatever reason, Anthropic wasn't hammering anywhere near as hard as Amazon and OpenAI were. Amazon and OpenAI represented saying the vast majority of the traffic of that server really doesn't get the sheer volume of it across. It might help instead to know that up until November of 2024, the site typically saw about 15,000 unique visitors and delivered about 600 megabytes of bandwidth every month on average. And that suddenly spiked in November of last year. And it spiked again in February of this year. And as of February and March, I was seeing several hundred thousand unique visitors to the sites. And the bandwidth used per month had gone up from the 600 megabytes that it had been for 15 years straight to 26 gigabytes per month. Adding insult to injury, I mentioned that, you know, they're hammering recent changes, right? And for example, I'm looking right now at Amazon bot is currently hammering the recent changes for which article is it? Oh, no, they've updated it now. Now they're hammering recent changes for the entire wiki. That's an improvement. It used to just be for an article. But they are still doing it from a different IP every time. And, oh, they've stepped it up. Now, instead of every other second, they're currently hitting the recent changes for the entire wiki at the rate of 3 times per second from a different IP address every time they hit it. And on a normal MediaWiki installation, this would be sufficient to just completely DOS the entire server with the database load because hitting recent changes on a MediaWiki site is not technically a cacheable request. You have to hit the database every single time. And as if that wasn't bad enough, they're also altering the arguments every time they ask the recent changes. They change when they say they want the recent changes from. And it's not just like they always say they want the recent changes from, you know, 5 minutes ago to now or from 10 minutes ago till now. No, it's a semi-random argument every time. And they also ask for a semi-random limit argument, meaning how many total entries might be provided. And the only reason to change those numbers up pseudo-randomly every time is to deliberately try to force a cache bypass by hitting you with a technically different URL every single time. Like I said, this would bring a normal server to its knees immediately. It would not be able to do anything else but hammer the storage and the CPU trying to fulfill all these database requests. The only reason this server stays up is because I put a custom Varnish rule set in front of this thing. So you're not actually talking directly to Apache or Nginx. You're going through Varnish. And if you're not a logged in user on that wiki, you are getting cached, period. And there's only so many different arguments you can give to the recent changes. So it's pretty quickly building up a cache and serving everything out of cache. But I mean, to say that this disgusts me and angers me, again, just really doesn't get it across. Like, these are tactics that make the absolute worst of the, you know, just completely black hat spammers that I've been dealing with for as long as I've been dealing with email and, you know, with hosted wikis and, you know, all this kind of thing. It puts the actual spammers to shame. I mean, they haven't gone anywhere and they're still a problem. They still suck. They're still like the SEMrush scrapers for the, you know, that's an SEO search engine that's just looking for who links to who. There's MJ12, which is another SEO search engine, you know, Majestic, that's based in the UK, which has been a plague on the internet for decades. And those are the next greatest amount of traffic to most any site that I run, including but not limited to this particular wiki. And again, they're not even a tiny fraction of the traffic that either Amazon or OpenAI is hitting me with these damn AI scrapers.
Yeah, and the FreeBSD project, for example, has been seeing its CGIT instance, which lets you browse the source revision history of FreeBSD, with huge amounts of traffic for similar things, trying to walk over like every commit or doing terrible things like looking at the history of each file individually or a history of each different directory and just basically all these things, again, that are hard to cache but are not what normal people would be doing browsing through the revision history. And at some point, it's like, well, we've tried every different aspect for trying to block those, and short of blocking certain entire countries, it doesn't seem that practical to be able to block the bots. And we can't, you know, just ban the country of Brazil because we have developers in Brazil that need access to this web service for real. And we have tons of links out there that point to this stuff. You know, even at Clara, we use that to like point our customers to, here's the commit, you paid for it, and now it's in the official upstream and you can see it here. And we're not going to put that behind some kind of login or something to try to fight off the bots. So it's just ruining everything. And to kind of Jim's point, if you were one of those gamer script kiddie kids who would like pay someone to DDoS another server for you, it turns out even being paid for it, most places can't seem to make as an effective denial of service attack as these AI people, because they have so many IP addresses to source from.
And it is just straight up malicious in so many ways that we probably ought to add some clarity here. Alan mentioned that, you know, there are a lot of people that are looking at trying to block entire countries at the IP level to avoid the load from these AI scrapers. And you kind of want to think that through. Well, why would you block a country? Why wouldn't you just block the data center that they're using, you know, for this? And the reason for that is the data centers have already been blocked. Now, at the moment, I'm not actually fighting this. I've been tolerating it, and now I'm kind of weighing my options moving forward, but I haven't done the robots.txt exclusions, and I haven't tried to just firewall off, you know, like Amazon. Amazon has a specific set of subnets for scraping even. So you could just block those subnets in theory. OpenAI also has their own data center, and right now, that's where I'm getting crawled from. But I already know, due to mainstream media coverage, that, you know, larger sites that have already started getting more aggressive with blocking these crawlers, well, those companies will get more aggressive right back. If you block their data centers, they use residential IP proxies in order to get to you anyway. That's the reason that blocking an entire country like Brazil starts looking more attractive, because usually what you find is that they're doing these residential IP proxies in other countries, not in America. And that's why it might seem attractive to block that other country, is because that other country is where all these residential proxies are coming from. But using a residential proxy to avoid an IP level block of a data center is just incredibly black hat. You also have to stop and ask yourself, how did this company get access to these residential IPs that in theory are probably being used in actual residences? And I don't know the answer to that question, but I can't come up with any legitimate ways to do that. I mean, that's the kind of thing that malware developers do. You know, they use compromised systems in friendly subnets to get around the blocks of the bulletproof hosting subnets. And that's exactly what OpenAI and Amazon and Meta are doing. And my understanding is Google is also doing that, although I haven't personally seen the Google AI crawling issue yet on my own boxes. But that's what I'm seeing in mainstream news, is that all of them are doing every shady tactic you've ever seen, you know, in 20 years of fighting outright spam and malware, and they're doing it harder.
It's proper scumbag behavior, that. There's no other word for it.
It feels like the malice is the point to some degree. I mean, you know, I like many nerds, am fond of quoting, you know, the adage Hanlon's razor, which is never attribute to malice that which can be explained by stupidity, or incompetence, if you prefer. But I'm having trouble coming up with any answer other than outright malice as to why these companies would want to hammer the recent changes on a MediaWiki site, or sometimes an individual MediaWiki article, multiple times per second, 24/7, 365, for months on end. What do you think you're getting out of hitting that multiple times per second instead of, like, I mean, you'd think once a day would be more than enough to look for the recent changes.
I reckon they just vibe coded the crawler, man.
You know, I hadn't considered that, and I really should have. That's an excellent freaking point.
And on the residential ISP thing, I wonder if they're somehow colluding with the ISP. It turns out if you have a residential ISP, all that eventually backhauls to a data center where all those IPs actually get on transit and go out to the internet. And especially if they're doing something like carrier grade NAT, they're like, yeah, we can totally sell you access to spoof out of all of our IP addresses for your bots. The malware people we saw in the past, like the bulletproof spam hosters, didn't have access to go do that. But if you're Amazon or OpenAI and you have enough money, I'm sure an ISP in Brazil would let you lob on to all of their IP addresses via a carrier grade NAT or something, so that they can still use the IP addresses at the same time.
I don't think that makes it even an iota less dirty. It just makes the ISP as dirty as they are. And we already knew ISPs are filthy.
Sure. It's not as dirty as putting malware on everybody's computer, but only marginally.
Very marginally. And, you know, usually when I'm not even sure how to differentiate, you know, the non-AI scraping scumbags from the new ones. But, you know, I can't say the prior generation of scumbags, because they're still very much with us. But the non-AI scumbags, the ones that we all know are full-on scumbags, and we're not having to argue about them being scumbags, like, they're not usually putting the malware on your computer either. You know, when they're using residential proxies, they're usually taking advantage of already malwared machines. And I certainly wouldn't put that past folks like Sam Altman. It's not an accusation, but my legally protected opinion is I don't think that dude would even begin to be above that, because I've read any number of interviews where he has literally talked about how any tactic is permissible if it advances the development of AI, because he claims that, you know, AI is going to be the permanent salvation of humanity, and we will reap so much untold good over so many infinite number of generations in the future that it just doesn't matter how bad we screw over anybody in the present.
Well, I imagine it's more the commercial interest of, like, well, if our scraper is more vicious than the other guy's scraper, then our AI is going to have more information to train on. And we got to get more information than the other guy's AI, and we have to do it sooner than the other guy's AI. So screw being polite and, you know, rate limiting things on the internet. Let's just go ruin the whole internet and, you know, bankrupt Wikipedia.
I'd get that if they were scraping your whole site once a day or something, but when you're hitting the same URL several times a second, they just, no, man, you're not getting any real benefit from that. You're burning your own resources as well as mine for absolutely no tangible good. So anyway, you know, I mentioned I'm not actually doing anything to directly fight this yet. And I don't think that the IP blocking is useful. I think that they have way too many ways around that. I've long since had to accept that there are hard limits to what I can do to keep a very determined asshat from touching my systems, you know, in ways that I allow the entire internet to touch my systems. That's a problem. When you say, okay, internet, I'm willing to serve you this thing, it's very hard to say, okay, entire internet, but not you. It turns out that's a very difficult problem to solve. And so I usually don't solve that problem. I mitigate it in some other way. And in this case, I don't think that trying to prevent your sites from being scraped is the answer. One, because it's not really possible. And two, I don't think it punishes the malefactors enough. What I'm looking at is I want to figure out what my best answer is going to be to cheerfully accept all the scrapers and feed them data that will poison the absolute crap out of the models. Because as far as I'm concerned, they've opened war on me. And the only appropriate response is to do it right back. And the way to do that is not to tar pit them and make the individual connections, you know, more expensive for them to handle, which is a technique I've employed against regular malware vendors and spammers and what have you. I think here, you know, the way to hit them in the bottom line is, you know, maybe you take half of the output or Project Gutenberg and you run it through, you know, one of those awful thesaurus filters that leaves you with something that's like, it's an attempt to get through spam filters by changing like every third word to the third or fourth alternate for it, you know, out of a thesaurus. Maybe take a bunch of Project Gutenberg stuff, run it through that kind of filter and like serve them that. Break the bot's ability to speak decent English. I think that might be one of the most damaging and the most rapidly effective things you can do. There are other potentially fun ideas, like what if you could just open a proxy and instead of getting your MediaWiki, what they actually get is an open proxy to their own LLM and they just get incestuous nonsense from their own LLM. So they have to pay to run the inference and they're dumping the crap back into their model, which also poisons models very quickly. I think that would be more complex. It would be easier for them to potentially work around. So as fun as that sounds, it's probably not what I'm going to do. But yeah, I'm all about at this point. You want to scrape my stuff? You want to be an asshat about it? All right, come on. See how you like it.
Okay, this episode is sponsored by people who support us with PayPal and Patreon. Go to 2.5admins.com/support for details of how you can support us too. Patreon supporters have the option to listen to episodes without ads like this. And it's not just this show. There's Late Night Linux for news, discoveries, audience input, and misanthropy. Linux Matters for upbeat family-friendly adventures. Linux After Dark for silly challenges and philosophical debates. Linux Dev Time about developing with and for Linux. Hybrid Cloud Show for everything public and private cloud, and ask the hosts for off-topic questions from you. You can even get some episodes a bit early. We've got a lot going on, and it's only possible because of the people who support us. So if you like what we do and can afford it, it would be great if you could support us too at 2.5admins.com/support. Let's do some free consulting then. But first, just a quick thank you to everyone who supports us with PayPal and Patreon. We really do appreciate that. And if you want to send in your questions for Jim and Alan or your feedback, you can email show@2.5admins.com. Another perk of being a patron is you get to skip the queue, which is what Penny has done. Penny writes, in episode 225, you mentioned Apple was finally adopting RCS, Rich Communication Services, which was great to hear since many people I know are iMessage users while I'm on Android. Do you know of any open source Android clients that support RCS? It seems like all of the news online relates to using RCS on Google Android, but I'm running a flavor of AOSP on my Pixel that's not logged into a Google account.
Turns out, probably not possible at the moment. So RCS is an industry standard, not an open standard. So while Google and Apple use it, Google only makes the APIs in Android available to themselves. No open source applications currently have access to those APIs to do the crypto and so on to actually use RCS. So currently, outside of using Google's Messenger app or an iPhone, there's no way to actually use RCS on your Android open source phone.
And to be clear, from my understanding, to implement RCS, you need low-level access that you would have to be granted by Google or Apple. You can't just like say, well, I didn't get the API, so I'll just, you know, write my own with hookers and blow in user space. It doesn't work that way. You need to be given access to fairly low level resources that Google and Apple just haven't given to anybody.
Yeah. And there might be some legitimate reasons for that on top of the actual reasons why Google isn't making that available. You can see how you wouldn't want malware to be able to spoof you as an RCS message and so on. But it does seem like if you really want good open source messaging, you probably don't want to be using RCS. It's just disappointing because it's basically the thing to replace SMS as the app everybody's phone is going to have, but we can't have nice things.
Well, it's also disappointing because the baked-in messaging functionality is just so bare and limited and not particularly consumer-friendly. The last I checked, Google Messages would not even allow you to so much as increase the font size, which, you know, in a world of tiny phones and my increasingly aging eyes is not great. I can't read text messages without my glasses on in the font that Google Messages uses and which I'm not allowed to change. That's actually what got me to start looking into a third-party texting app to begin with. I use an open source one called Textra, and it's been wonderful. Textra, of course, the first and foremost thing was it allowed me to change the font and the font size on the messages, which was crucial. I needed to be able to see it without glasses on. And it did that. But I also just love having an open source app for texting. And it has other features that I really like. But again, the big thing is I wasn't looking to ditch Google Messaging for a third-party app. I did that a long time ago because I had to. And so it's really annoying to me that I feel like RCS is gated off inside an app that just doesn't meet even basic modern usability needs. And the carrier just doesn't really care.
Well, in this case, it's not so much the carrier as the phone vendor, but yeah.
Yeah, fair. The phone manufacturer doesn't care. It's kind of a weird spot at this point, though, because it doesn't feel like you can really quite say the phone manufacturer either, because to the best of my knowledge, this is still really, you have to lay this at Google's feet, whether you happen to personally be rocking a Pixel or not. It's the OS vendor's fault.
Harold, who's a patron, also skipped the queue. He writes, I'm a working member of an art gallery. We use Gmail and Google Drive. I got an email from a member who no longer works there who said she was having trouble watching YouTube videos on her own YouTube account, and it appeared she was using the gallery account but no longer has access to it, and could I please log in and remove her as admin? We don't have an admin. We have a basic Google account set up 15 years ago before I was a member. Members access the account on their own computers using the gallery login or the store computer when they are working there. I checked the gallery account activity and saw that our former member was watching YouTube videos. I then checked the gallery Google Drive and was horrified to find other people's files and folders, including a financial file of my own family's LLC. How did this happen? I checked my own Google Drive and there was nothing extra or missing or askew. I went back to the gallery drive and deleted all the files not related to the gallery. Google search did not help me. What should I do?
So there's not really enough detail here to know exactly what's going on, but I have hit something like this myself, especially with YouTube. So my YouTube account happens to have delegated access to a couple of other YouTube accounts to, you know, upload videos for conferences or the monthly ZFS leadership meetings. And so that's its own account that I don't have the password to, but my YouTube account is allowed to act on behalf of that YouTube account. And if the last thing I did was upload a video to one of those accounts and I forgot to switch back, then suddenly my viewing history is being recorded in the wrong Google account. And I happen to have more than one Google account. And yes, it's very easy to accidentally be switched into the account in a Google Suites thing that's not my main account and end up saving a file in the wrong place and then not being able to find it later. Although in this case, it's unclear if there's actually G Suite involved at all, or if the gallery just has one regular Gmail account that they're all sharing, which is probably a really bad idea. And I'm surprised Google hasn't locked you out and demanded you have three different MFA and approval from two different devices every time you try to log in because you're logging in from multiple locations and so on. But you definitely want to be careful when using Google and multiple accounts. Ideally, the best way if you have to actually do that yourself is having separate browser profiles so that you don't mix the chocolate and the peanut butter, because otherwise you end up like the patron here with accidentally saving some of their financial files for their LLC into the gallery's Google Drive account. And they definitely didn't mean to do that. And so if it's happening even to our patron, let alone a more regular end user at the gallery, it's very likely that this confusion is happening repeatedly.
And before anyone writes in to tell us that G Suite is now called Google Workspace, we don't care.
Just wait a week. It'll be called something else.
Probably.
This really sounds like something that would benefit from getting a consultant on site to take a look at it, because there's so much imprecision in the description of the problem and exactly what's going on in the history that I didn't even personally want to take a stab at this one on air, because I feel like somebody really needs to get actual local direct eyes on the problem before we start saying what's what. I agree with Alan, that does sound like the most likely issue, that people just weren't noticing which Google account they were active in most likely in Chrome when they were doing things. That would explain both, the family LLC files showing up, as well as the other user, having YouTube viewing history on the gallery account. That would explain all of that, but I'd really like to see it, or to have somebody actually directly see it rather than just go by a description. The other thing I'll add is that if you're sloppy enough not to notice which Google profile you're logged into at the moment, you're probably not going to be great about noticing which browser profile you're using at the moment either. So you might want to consider an entirely separate work browser. Like, use Chrome for your personal stuff and Edge for your work stuff, or vice versa. I get that some people might not want to treat Chrome and Firefox as, functionally identical, because there are some sites that don't work very well in one browser that work fine in the other. But I have yet to encounter much of anything that works properly in Chrome, but not in Edge, or vice versa.
Scott, who's a patron, also skipped the queue. He writes, I have a question about how Jim and Alan handle their WireGuard configs. My use case is scaling a single cloud-based Nagios instance to be able to reach multiple sites, probably less than 200 servers, counting both virtual and physical. Keeping track of which subnets are where with individual allowed IPs settings per peer just sounds like a nightmare, especially considering how many small business networks are set up with the quintessential 192.168.1.x/24. So my thought was to create a single /16 network for the WireGuard tunnel subnet, with a single VPS acting as both a lighthouse and a monitoring server, and give each device I need to monitor its own WireGuard IP. Considering the size of the infrastructure I'm dealing with, I can't imagine ever exhausting that subnet. Curious as to your thoughts.
I've looked at a couple of different solutions for basically managing the IP allocations for WireGuard, because it doesn't have something just automatically allocate IP addresses, something kind of like an equivalent of DHCP or something. It was a couple of years ago when I looked, but none of the options were great. There were some web UIs that would like auto-generate the stuff for you and assign static IPs and make it a little more manageable, but they were basically just maintaining the database for you, not actually automating coming up with things for each one. Just as you added profiles, it would assign them an address that wasn't in use and make sure you didn't get conflicts, but it wasn't the same as just like, assign people addresses as they connect, or something that would be less complicated.
So what I did is a lot like the idea that he mentions at the end, creating a single /16 for the WireGuard, and a single VPS acts as, sort of the central machine. And then each individual device to be monitored gets its own WireGuard IP, has its own tunnel, rather than, setting each office up and, trying to route between the offices and all that. I don't do that. I do the individual machines. Everything I monitor has its own WireGuard tunnel directly to my monitoring server. I'm not using a /16. I forget what the slash designation is, but it's basically four class Cs, wedged together is what I'm using.
That'd be a 22.
And it works really well. Now, the thing that I will mention, if these are separate small businesses, if these are separate clients, you do want to make absolutely certain that you put firewall rules in on the machine that you're using as, the central hub for the whole thing. And you want that central machine to refuse to allow traffic from the monitored machines to it beyond maybe just a ping, maybe allow return ping so that you can monitor that the connection works. But otherwise, it should be stuffing any communication attempt that originates with those boxes. It should be allowed to talk to them and receive their replies, but they should not be allowed either to talk to it or to each other through it. And that way, you can have your single subnet, but not be compromising basic infosec policies that then expose one of your customers to a different customer's bad decisions. Because that's what we would call a resume generating event if you're a salaried person, and perhaps a new career generating event if you're self-employed.
Yeah, there's another thing you mentioned here about, you know, a bunch of these small business network studies having to link together using the same, you know, the quintessential 192.168.0 or .1 subnet, which could complicate things. On FreeBSD, there's this concept of a VNet jail, which basically creates a separate network namespace. And so you could have a separate WireGuard in each one, and they can have conflicting IP addresses on the same machine without actually generating a conflict. And I think you can do something similar with containers on Linux using network namespaces, where you could have a bunch of different containers that each had a different 192.168.1.something in them. It gives you kind of, by nature, what Jim was talking about, is separating those clients so that they can't talk to each other. But if they actually need to have IP addresses that are going to overlap, you're WireGuard machines needs to be able to disambiguate that 192.168.1.100 from this other 192.168.1.100. And so having a namespace either via VNet jails on FreeBSD or a network namespace from Linux, at that point, though, you're running a separate WireGuard for each customer, which, you know, you mentioned 200 servers. That's a lot of WireGuard in the first place, let alone if you actually turn that into 20 WireGuards of 10 machines, it's not really any more work in the end, but it is that much more thought you have to put into it all the time, and especially figuring out if you want your workstation to just be able to connect to any of these 200 servers, it gets more complicated.
The last thing that I'll mention is, you know, when we talk about the IP allocation on the WireGuard side. Now, again, I have an individual tunnel to each machine I'm monitoring, so I really don't care if those machines have conflicting subnets on their LAN, because I don't need to talk to them using their LAN. I just talk to them over the WireGuard subnet, so there's no conflict. But as far as managing the IPs that are available in my WireGuard subnet, if you've ever used WireGuard, you'll be aware DHCP is not really an option, but that does not have to be a deal breaker. It doesn't mean that you have to do really ponderous manual IP address management. I wrote a small script, which it's on my GitHub if you want to go looking for it. I wouldn't really call it ready for like mainstream use, which is why I don't like advertise it anywhere, but it's quite useful for me. You give it a little bit of configs on what the basics of the WireGuard template configuration should look like, basically, and tell it which interface you're using, and the script just queries that interface to see what IP addresses are used and what IP addresses are available on that subnet. And then it says, okay, here's my first available IP address. It sticks that IP address in the new config, sticks in, you know, a new private key, pub key, all that good stuff, generates the config and tells you, I'm about to add a new host with public key and then the actual public key into my live configs. Proceed, yes or no. And if you tell it yes, then it dumps, you know, the new host config into the interface configs, hups the config so that the new thing is live, and then just spits out the config on the terminal. So you can just copy that from the terminal, paste it into a text file on your client, and boom, you got WireGuard. Everything's ready and working. Now, the other step is that I would strongly recommend running a private DNS zone. I use .wg for WireGuard. And then your last step is that IP address for that new machine. You put that machine's host name in that private DNS zone file so that then you can ping newmachine.wg and whatever that IP address happened to be that the script assigned it when you first added that machine to your network. That'll just always work. So in the future, you're not trying to remember raw IP addresses or manage raw IP addresses. All you got to do is know the host name.
Right, well, we better get out of here then. Remember show@2.5admins.com if you want to send any questions or your feedback. You can find me at joelrest.com/mastodon.
You can find me at mercenarysysadmin.com.
And I'm at Alan Jude.
We'll see you next week.